We will dispense with questions right now because we are 1 minute over. We will call for the next speaker, who is Andrew Sessler. And he will talk about early thoughts on the superfluidity of helium-3.
I'll try to use this microphone, and maybe that will be less noisy. I've approached this talk sort of the way I would approach after-dinner speech. I had many stories, a few jokes, and a hidden message. I hope you'll find this interesting. In this paper, I want to talk about our initial work on the superfluidity of helium-3. It's an honor to be here with the work so preliminary and almost in all regards wrong. I might have thought a celebration of the 50th anniversary of a prediction of superfluidity could well have been conducted without my recollections. I want to talk about three papers shown in the slides. So this was the first paper, which was with Leon Cooper and Bob Mills. And I always thought this was a more important paper, but that's not the one being celebrated here. The one being celebrated here is the second one, which I wrote with Vic Emery. And that's where we made a numerical, of course, completely wrong, prediction of where superfluidity would occur. And then Al Glasgow and I wrote a third paper in which we discussed some of the flow properties of an anisotropic superfluid. I can think of many, many people who worked on this, and Phil Anderson mentions many of them, so I think I won't go through the list again. There are surely even some that are not mentioned that contributed to this development, if you will. I would like to talk about the various unpublished aspects of these three papers. The talk will complement, if you will, the published works, make it a little more human, perhaps, and of course that's just the way it was, and at the same time, hopefully be interesting. I will cover the physics, but just rather briefly, because that you can read about in the papers, and as I said, it was mostly wrong. But it did stimulate some very good theoretical and experimental work. Since this is a history session, I thought it would be acceptable if I go a bit afield and go back and tell you a bit about my graduate education. It's relevant, actually. I was at Columbia from 1949 to 1953. Nobelist and grand old man Isidore Isaac Rabie took me out to lunch one day, just as I was getting my PhD. I think he did that with all graduating students. As we walk along after lunch, he bemoaned to me the fact that physics at Columbia just wasn't as great as it used to be. He remarked that the theoretical work was second rate, and the experimental work, well, even if it worked, and he strongly implied that none of it would work, these experiments would not be of any interest. Certainly, none of them were of Nobel Prize caliber. Subsequently, and for work which was going on just then, Nobel Prizes were given to five of the staff, Polycarp Cush, Charlie Towns, T.D. Lee, Jean Rainwater, and Willis Lamb. In subsequent years, when I was in administrative work, I often thought of this. Thank you. Okay. I'm missing a lot. I'll try. Maybe this will work better. In subsequent years, when I was an administrator, I often thought of this remark and realized, so it's this. Point out how far out of it an administrator can be. At Columbia, I had courses from 7 Nobel Prize winners, all of the above, as well as Robbie and Yukawa. And the other members of the staff were excellent physicists like John Dunning, the first physician in the United States, Madame Wu, Parity, Henry Foley, Clish Foley experiment, Bob Serber, Oppie's right-hand man, Norman Cole, QED, and on and on. And often passing through Columbia were future Nobelists, and studying for long times, Jack Steinberger, Norman Ramsey. And of my fellow graduate students, 5 went on to win Nobel Prizes: Letterman, Schwartz, Pearl, Fitch, and Cooper. And many of the others had excellent physics careers. Probably you will recognize names like Bob Frosch, Francis Lowe, Bob Mills, Peter Franken, Ali Javan, Jim Gordon, Gabi Weinreich, Arnold Honig, William Chernowsky, Joe Sucher, Evan Wiechmann, Eugene Cummings, and on and on. Columbia in those days was really quite unbelievable. This was the milieu in which Bob Mills and Leon Cooper and I were trained. We were taught the elements of physics, but we were taught much more. Namely, that physics was exciting, a wonderful sport, and we needed to aim high. I've just written, sort of stimulated actually by this talk, an essay called Recollections about my those days at Columbia, more extensive than what I've just mentioned. And the Columbia Physics Department has put it on its website, actually. Upon graduating, both Bob Mills and I won NSF postdoctoral fellowships. That was the first year of such fellowships, actually. Where to go? Well, Bob was advised to go to the Institute for Advanced Study, where he developed with Frank Yang the Yang-Mills theory. And I think I have a slide of these two gentlemen. I was advised that the Institute was not my kind of thing, and that going to Cornell and working with Hans Bethe would be more my kind of physics. I did that, but after 1 year, I had 2 years of a fellowship, actually. I was offered a job at Ohio State, and Bethe suggested that sooner or later I would have to be on my own. So since jobs were hard to come by, I should ought to take this one and go to Ohio State, which I did, and my job there was to teach nuclear physics. I arrived at Ohio State in the fall of 54, and looking over the department, quickly saw that there was world-class physics being done in molecular spectroscopy, which seemed almost like chemistry to me, and that was very low down, although my son is a chemist. Then people had pointed out that I failed. But excellent work was being done in low-temperature physics under John Daunt. And I have 2 pictures of John Daunt. Here's one and the second. I decided, maybe this is Robbie's influence, to become a low-temperature physicist. My thesis work was on atomic nuclear structure physics. The Cornell years were spent doing elementary particle physics, and I was hired to do nuclear physics. But in those days, it was much easier than it is now to move from one subfield to another. During that year, my first year at Ohio State, I was put in charge of the colloquia. I had to round up speakers, meet them at the airport, take them to the physics department to lunch, bring them back to the airport, and so on. And someone suggested to me that Don Kirst would be an interesting speaker, as he was heading the Midwestern University's research organization, the Mura Group. At the end of the long day, he asked me what I was doing that summer, and I had no plans, and he invited me to do accelerator physics research at Michigan. I did that, and eventually that became my life work, actually. It is relevant because as we shall soon see, as we will see in a few moments. Actually, I just co-authored a book on Midwestern University Research Association, MURA, and it's just been published. It's called Innovation Was Not Enough. Also in that year, I convinced the department to make an offer to Bob Mills.
The summer on accelerator physics proved sufficiently exciting that I decided to take a leave from Ohio State from January 56 to September 56, 9 months, and spent with Mura, located in Illinois, for that academic year. I arrived in Urbana just a few months after Leon Cooper had finished his thesis in high-energy physics at Columbia under Jim Rainwater, and was now working with Bardeen. He was not interested in working on the details of superconductivity, but as Leon had explained to me earlier at the APS meeting that spring of 1955, he wanted to solve the conundrum of superconductivity. Leon and I were rather close, visiting each other's homes frequently and discussing many things besides physics, such as music and politics and so on. And I have a couple of pictures of Leon. At one point, he complained how his postdoc experience was not working out very well, as Bardeen was uninterested in what Leon was doing and wanted Leon to engage in tedious calculations of superconductivity. Sometimes later, John Bardeen took me aside and said that since I was a friend of Leon's, maybe I could get through to Leon and get him to work on various aspects of superconductivity rather than the abstract work which Leon was doing. Well, both of these guys were saying the same thing, and I didn't know what to do. In fact, I did nothing. A bit later, Leon gave a fine theoretical seminar on Cooper pairs. He was shouted down by some very famous physicists, I'll withhold their names, who pointed out that everyone knew that bound states couldn't have positive energy. Fortunately, Bardeen was smarter. Let me now talk about the Cooper-Mills paper. Upon returning to Ohio State in the fall of 56, I worked with Bob Mills on an NSF grant that we had garnered, $40,000 a year for 2 years, or maybe $40,000 for 2 years, I don't really remember. But anyway, lots of money. That was supposed to cover many-body theory. And from the low-temperature physicists, we learned about Landau theory of a Fermi liquid. In fact, the theory had been confirmed to some degree by Daunt and Rua, measurement of the specific heat of helium-3, which showed a behavior linear with temperature. And here are some pictures of Doug Brewer. In the fall of 58, Dave Edwards joined the experimental group and even for the first year shared an office with me. Here, pictures of Dave Edwards. Although BCS theory was only just started to be recognized, I was able to convince the department in 1957 to make an offer to Leon Cooper. So he arrived in the fall of 58, but only stayed 1 year. So, steeped in BCS theory, which Bob Mills and I studied deeply, and surrounded on all sides by folks who believe strongly in the Landau theory of quasi-particles and helium-3, it was only natural for me to ask if BCS theory could be extended to strongly interacting fermions. It didn't take long to do that. After all, Leon loved formal, abstract, fundamental questions. Think of Cooper pairs. And Bob was one of the most consummate mathematicians I have ever met. Think of his work with Yang. Doug Brewer, who was much more into the community of low-temperature physicists than I, says that at that time, most people, even most low-temperature people, didn't believe that helium-3 would ever become a superfluid. They believed this mostly because there was no transition in the ideal Fermi gas. John Dort was a non-believer in superfluidity and tried to convince Doug Brewer to say in their PhysRev letter that the linear specific heat proved this, Fortunately, Doug Brewer refused. Brewer often even recalls, and I don't, but he says, that Leon Cooper at first was very doubtful that helium-3 would become a superfluid, as there were no phonons to mediate the interaction. Let me show a few of the crucial equations from that paper, and I'll go very fast. So this is not to teach physics, but just to remind us, if you will, of what we were doing. Everyone knows we wrote a Hamiltonian for the system and a two-body potential, V R minus R prime, and then we transformed this, and we, following a BCS theory, if you will, assume, well, we can only have pairs, so we made creation operators, destruction operators, BK, which are products of single particle creation operators of opposite momentum, and then we wrote the Hamiltonian out in terms of that. And then we used a trial function, really the Schrieffer trial function on BCS type theory, and we played with that, and we showed that, we could rewrite the Hamiltonian this way, and finally we arrived at an equation. And this chi represents now the additional interaction between particles. So this is where ideal Fermi theory breaks down, if you will. This is an expression that gives you the first correction to ideal theory. So we could write the existence, the criterion for the existence of a superstate is then that we have a solution of this equation written there with a certain Green's function. And we had now to look at this equation in some detail. And then we did all that. You can see the consummate mathematics of these other guys, especially Bob. And a variational principle was derived. And this became a criterion for superfluid at some sufficiently low temperatures, simply that this equation has a solution, and we had to find various trial functions simply to see whether this was less than zero. I think that's all. And the similar criterion was derived by Russians. And we went on and showed that despite the possibility of a superfluid, when the best potential of helium-3 was employed, there was no superfluidity. I think that's all. Yeah. Leon and I were very disappointed with this negative result. I don't believe Bob was as emotionally involved as the rest of us. And in preparation for this talk, Leon and I looked back and tried to figure out why we didn't think of higher angular momentum states, why only S states. And we concluded that it was because we got so involved with the elegant mathematics that Bob Mills would produce every night, one variational principle after another, one more elegant way of looking at things, that we never could step back and think a little bit, hey, what if we went to higher momentum states? Of course, I'm not blaming Bob. If anything, it was Leon's fault and my fault. We quite agree to that. All right, the following year, I had a sabbatical, and to the surprise of the faculty, almost all of whom spent sabbaticals in Europe and urged me to do the same, I elected to spend the months, the fall of 59 to June of 60 at the Lawrence Radiation Lab. There I was put into a tiny little space, a rabbit hut, really, with a guy I never heard of called Vic Emery, who was on a Harkness Fellowship from the Commonwealth Fund of New York. Picture of Vic. I actually have a second one also. Vic was born in Boston, Lincolnshire, England, where he attended Stanland School and Boston Grammar School. He was a fine swimmer and was won the town's one-mile swimming race any number of times on the Boston River, on the Witham River. And he became the star goal scorer of the Boston Polo, water polo team. So he was really quite good at that. He studied physics at the University of Hull and the University of London, and then became a student in the University of Manchester, where he obtained a PhD. He subsequently had spent 2 years at the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge before coming to the Lawrence Radiation Lab, still at the age of 26. After hard work, he went back to England and was a lecturer at the University of Birmingham. And according to Wikipedia, well, you can't believe everything you read on Wikipedia. As a result of his work at Berkeley, he was invited to join the Brookhaven National Lab, which he did in 1964. I can think of other reasons, but that's what Wikipedia says. His many subsequent contributions to condensed matter physics are well known and were recognized in a number of ways, such as his being voted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and then being awarded the Buckley Prize both in 2001. I had come to Berkeley to do high energy physics, certainly not to waste any of my time on the dead end of superfluidity of helium-3. Vic had heard from Ben Bartelson that there might be Cooper pairs in higher momentum states, and this would allow helium-3 to become superfluid. Vic had already shown that a sufficient condition for pairs was that the phase shift of a scattering state with the same angular momentum and kinetic energy of a quasi-particle near the Fermi surface be positive. All right. In retrospect, it seems so obvious to anyone who knew anything about quantum mechanics, and I'd been teaching a year-long course for a number of times, that one should go to higher momentum states to avoid guys banging into the nucleus in an atom. All right. Later, I learned that Phil Anderson had even proposed this in 1968. And maybe there are some earliest ones. All right. So higher angular momentum states was such an obviously good idea that I immediately gave up the idea about doing high energy physics. In fact, it only took us 5 months to develop the formalism and do the necessary numerical work. Phase shift studies showed that the most likely states were L equal 1, 2, and 3, with 2 the most likely. It doesn't seem necessary for me to go through the formalism, but better just jump to the basic equation and then comment a bit about the numerical work. The formal work of extending the work of Cooper and Mills to higher angular momentum states was rather straightforward. What was more difficult was putting the basic equation into a form which was numerically robust. And that, of course, doing the numerical work and being confident of the result. So here are a few more equations. All right, so here is the... Well, that's almost self-explanatory, if you will. It says everything I could say. And the experimental work of Doug Brewer and Daunt had shown that the specific heat compared to the specific heat of an ideal Fermi gas was exactly a straight line, but twice the slope. And that's why, in fact, Daunt had proposed that they make some remark about it not being a superfluid, which Doug was smart enough to reject. But that meant that we had to use, that these quasi-particles had an effective mass, which was 2. Okay. And we used that then in the calculation. And so here are some more equations. And then we had to put in the two-body potentials. Well, there were two-body potentials floating around at that time that were taken relatively seriously. And one is the Lennard-Jones potential and the Intimate-Schneider potential, and we use both of these at different times in our calculations. The numerical work was carried out on the Berkeley campus, as the Lawrence Radiation Lab at that time didn't have a computer. Now it's the DOE Center for Computing, but at that time it had no computer. The first time I arrived at the computer, and here is a picture of the IBM 704, the operator got up and said, okay, you have 15 minutes, and he started to walk out of the room. And I shouted after him, what are we supposed to do? What do I do now? All right, and he showed me, oh, you hit this button and that button. And on subsequent times, I was quite able to run the computer myself. And I guess my time at Mura, where we had used the ILAC, came in good stead also. At least I wasn't afraid of being around computers. I noticed that the paper, I noticed long ago, that the paper by Buckner, Soda, Anderson, and Morell makes no reference to the paper by Vic and myself. No, do we make any reference to the paper by Anderson and Buckner at all? I do remember an incident that I believe tells something of the competitiveness of that time. Keith Buckner visited LBL, and during that visit came by to talk with Vic and me. And the three of us squeezed into our tiny office, a little rabbit hutch, and I recall that we talked at great length about Vic and I, about the work we had done, and it was just almost, this was like December or January, and we were going to publish in a few weeks or a month after that. And Keith didn't say a word about the fact that he was working on a similar problem. Let me go on to the third paper, which was with Al Glasgow. Al Glasgow and I, while I was still at Berkeley on the same sabbatical leave, became fascinated with the concept of an anisotropic fluid, such as helium-3 would be after it became superfluid. So we're now studying, okay, suppose we got a superfluid. Well, it would take another 12 years before we got one, but suppose we had one. What would it behave like? Al was a postdoc at the radiation lab, and he subsequently has had an outstanding career at New York University. There's another picture of Al. We studied the effective mass of flow through a straight channel and the moments of inertia for the rotation of a cylindrical bucket of the fluid. I remember the many wonderful discussions that we had, perhaps even more fun than the work with Vic. For the work with Vic was rather straightforward and just plain hard work, whereas there was so much to discuss with assuming that we had such a fluid, you know, there was what would happen? How would the anisotropy of the fluid have an effect on its flow? We discussed anisotropy directions. How does that line up with the axis of rotation or otherwise? Work by Landau and Lifshitz already existed on anisotropic fluids, and work by Bardeen and by Kolotnikov and Abrikosov already existed on the flow of spherically symmetric superfluids, and the relation between BCS theory and the two-fluid model. So it was rather easy to take these two theories, one on anisotropic fluids and one on isotropic but superfluids, and put them together and discuss what would happen if you had an anisotropic superfluid, and that's in fact what we did. So I skipped the formalism. What we did was we first worked out the momentum that such a fluid flowing would have, and we found that depending on whether the fluid was flowing along the axis of a symmetry, or that it would be one value, but if it went in a different direction, it would be another, and some combination of them. And that's how the cosine signs come in there. And we also worked out the moment of inertia of the fluid, and there it was assumed that the axis was lined up with the axis of rotation, so only the perpendicular can see only the K2 corresponding to moving in the perpendicular direction came in. All very obvious, but good fun. All right. So, in conclusion, those were wonderful times. It was just good fun for each of us. Of course, we were naive, and we ventured, as young folks are inclined to do, into new and unknown territory. At the time of the Cooper Mills work, the three of us were 28, 30, and 30. The youngest was Leon, and he had already done Nobel Prize-winning work. At the time of the Emory work, we were 26 and 31, and Vic was the younger one. So we were... I only did a little bit more of many-body physics, sort of in accord with the concept of limiting the damage. One contribution was really okay. It was with Bob, which led to Bob Mills's book on propagators for many particle systems. And Gordon Baim and I wrote a paper on applying many-body theory to atomic structure in a systematic way of calculating perturbations. And I could go into that, but the red light is on. So I think I'll quit here. I've been showing slides of my coworkers, more or less at the time when they were still young and vigorous. And it's only fair, I thought, to show you a picture of myself at that time so that you can see I didn't always look like this. That was... Thank you.